We're Proverbs 13:20 right now. We didn't quite finish chapter 13 last week. In this chapter, we have seen in the first three verses listening and speaking. The important when Solomon addresses his son, he focuses on an individual here, and he's saying you got to pay attention and you have to learn how to speak correctly and appropriately. Verses 4 to 6 is about our intentions bleeding over into our actions. We know as human beings that oftentimes we have good intentions and the actions don't seem to follow them. So there's an exhortation throughout Scripture as to not only have the good intention, but to try and carry them out in our behaviors. We've seen in verse 7 to 13 about wealth and poverty, things that bring about wealth, things that bring about poverty. We've seen in 14 to 19 a contrast between good and bad students. And now we're going to see some comparisons between decisions and discipline. And in verse 20, it says, "He who walks with wise men will be wise." Probably the first thing to do is find a wise man to walk with. And notice it's a promise. It's a condition. He who walks with wise men, what? Will be wise. That's the first promise. And that promise is that good company builds wisdom. Okay, good company builds wisdom. We know from 1 Corinthians 14:40 that bad associations corrupts the character. We've seen that before. So the word is inherently evil association corrupts good morals. So this is saying walk with people who are wise in what they do. He says, but the companion of fools will suffer harm. That's also a promise. And the second promise there is that bad company corrupts good morals. So where did Paul get that from? When we start seeing Proverbs and we start connecting the dots, it's still fascinating to me that we see counterparts in the New Testament, which is further proof that the New Testament is writing about the fulfillment of Messiah, but it is also carrying on some important principles of ethics and character and how then we should live. So here are two promises. If you want to be smart, walk with smart people. Walk with wise people. Verse 21 says, adversity pursues sinners. The word for sinners here, and I'm going to try to bring them out as we go through, because we're going to see in the next chapter a different word for sin. This word is kata, C-H-A-T-A. And kata is a word that is used for the sin offering in Leviticus 4, primarily about unknown sins. These are the things that we don't consciously know of, or maybe don't even know that we're violating one of God's standards. And this is the kata word that falls into that category. But he says, adversity pursues even the unknown sins. There are going to be problems that are going to follow you, because they are sins, and they just really are not they're not the way to do things. So there will be a deserved suffering that follows along, even when we're involved in unknown sins. But the righteous, contrast of sinner and righteous, the righteous are the ones not involved in unknown sins, because they've tried to figure out what's pleasing in the eyes of the Lord. So although we're not going to get rid of all of them in our life, we can at least cut the numbers down. What we want to do is know what's right, what's wrong, and at least have a shot at getting them right. And that's what we're seeing in this, in the Proverbs, and I was working on Psalm 119 today, and we see the same thing is being taught in Psalm 119. It's just it's consistent message all the way through. So the promise here is in verse 21 is that righteousness, it says the righteous will be rewarded with prosperity. That's the English, but it literally says the righteous will be rewarded with good. The word for prosperity is tov. It is the generic word for good. It's as generic as you can get it, T-O-B-H. And it'll be the righteous, the tzaddik, will be rewarded with that, with good. And when it uses a generic word, it's saying it can come in all kinds of forms. The word rewarded, I like that word because that's the word shalom, S-H-A-L-A-M. Shalom is where we get shalom from. This is the verb form of shalom. So it means to be at peace, you know, just like the shalom. That's what it looks like in the Hebrew. That's why Spock did it in Star Trek. He meant shalom. That's what he was saying. Live long and prosper, because that's what shalom means. And that's the Hebrew sheen, which is that's what that meant. So that's pretty cool sign that he tucked in there. Leonard Nimoy was a Jew, and he knew what it was, and he managed to get that thing plugged in. And a few of us really liked that sign that he had. It's going to be rewarded with what? Peace, prosperity, those type of things. Righteousness will be rewarded with good. Now, verse 22 says, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. The good man here he's talking about is one that thinks ahead, one that just doesn't live for himself, to do everything for himself, but thinks ahead into future generations, into the grandson. And the word leaves is nakal. Leaves an inheritance is nakal, which is in the hifil. It means a cause to inherit. It means he's putting in with an intentional idea of trying to leave something behind, not just for his immediate children, but for their children as well. So it is the idea of thinking ahead. Verse 23, abundant food is in the fallow ground of the poor. Fallow is really a word means tilled. Okay, and so abundant food is in the tilled ground of the poor. Now, if you're poor but you got some tilled ground, then it could produce some food. That's what it's trying to get at. It says, but it is swept away by injustice. Now, injustice can come from people that won't let the poor work through whatever ground or land that they've got. That's part of that injustice. It's also injustice whenever you've been provided even this little thing and you're so lazy you don't even get out and do it. So it's saying, there in this tilled ground, you could at least plant a potato. Okay? You know, Matt Damon did it on Mars. So, I mean, you ought to at least be able to plant a potato and live through a potato factory, you know, and of course those wonderful carbs. Anyway, but he says it's there. Okay, it's tilled ground. There's nothing necessarily planted, but it could be, and it could produce. But if you don't want to do anything, if you don't sow, you won't reap, is what it's basically saying. Verse 24, this is a good one. Proverbs 13:24. That's emblazoned on some refrigerators, I think. It's probably not politically correct. I know it's not politically correct anymore, but it says, he who spares his rod hates his son. This word is the word shebet. S-H-E-B-E-T-H. Now, shebet, let's see this way. Shebet is a word for rod, but when we think of a rod, all we think of is a stick. But this meaning of this word is so much deeper than that, because this is the word that is used for the ruler's staff. It is the same word that is used for the tribes, because each tribe of Israel had their own banner and they had their own staff. There was the ruler's staff that went along with it. Now, what this is basically saying, he who spares his rod or spares his authority being used wisely, it's not saying that you take a kid and beat him to death. That's not what it means. What it's saying is that the ruler's staff is used for a lot more things. It's used to guide the family, protect the family. That's what it's talking about here. So if a man keeps this away and doesn't teach his children, teach them respect. I mean, all types of things. It says, he who spares his rod hates his son. That's a pretty heavy statement, isn't it? Whenever the word especially is looking at the wise use of authority that is there, not just whether or not they ought to get a switch in every now and then, but whether they're using that wisely. Because some people did not spare the switch and were very unwise in what they did. And I mean, there's documented case after documented case of that. But he who loves him disciplines him diligently. Discipline is musar, M-U-S-A-R. We've seen that word before. And that's the word that means to teach with an attitude of correction. So here is the man taking the authority he's got, symbolized in the ruler staff of the family. He's using it to properly teach and educate his children. And his objective is correction of wrong behaviors. That's part of what he's doing. So Proverbs 13:24 is a lot more involved than what you get in a simple English reading. It is really a beautiful verse that is important about, and it's he doesn't relegate it to mom. Okay, there's a lot of implications that just come out of an individual look at these words found in this verse. Verse 25, the righteous has enough to satisfy his appetite. The word appetite is the word nephesh, which is the word for soul. So they get a little bit too liberal. Even the conservative translators get a little too liberal with the translations. Because when you're looking at the word soul here, it says that the righteous has enough to satisfy his soul. Paul was righteous and didn't have anything, and he said, I've learned to be content with a little, I've learned to be content with a lot. That's what it's talking about. And I'm sure that Paul, having known the Old Testament as well as he did, when he's sitting there and he hasn't got much, he's going, I've got enough. Righteousness is all I need to satisfy my soul. It's not about my appetites and my human appetites that is important. He said, but the stomach of the wicked is in want. He said, the stomach of the wicked is never going to have enough. Never going to be the right thing. Never going to be enough. Always going to be something wrong with it. Just like the Jews in the desert. You know, we need meat. All you send us is stupid manna. Miraculously, every day, 6 days in a row, except the seventh day. It doesn't happen because we got twice as much on the sixth day. But we don't like that. Bring us meat. Or the too much water, the no water, and the bad water test. All the things they did, they complained about. But the righteous, see, if they'd have walked out there in righteousness, like Moses did, as the leader, They'd have been that promised land 40 years earlier. That's what would have happened. They would have been walking around in the desert out there sweating like they were. So, principle. Good decisions have good effects. That's about as simple as it gets. Good decisions have good effects, and bad decisions lead to discipline. they used to have a saying over there, Glenhaven, prominently posted, bad decisions limit future options. That might as well have been a proverb. Okay. So, good decisions, good effects. Bad decisions lead to discipline. Now, in these five verses, we have seen five decisions to be made here. The first one is pursuit of righteousness. Second one is about stewardship. Wise man leaves an inheritance. Third one is about hard work. Because even the poor, if he's got a place to play at something, can bring something about. Fourth is about child training. Who spares a rod hates his son. The fifth one is about contentment. See, look at these are decision things to be made. So those are the good decisions. The bad decisions, the discipline. There'll be discipline for unknown sins. What is it? Adversity. It means it can come from every stinking direction. How about lack of stewardship? There's not going to be anything to be left. Injustice to the poor. If they're one of the ones that that the poor get ready to plant, and they're going to come in and lay claim to it. And they're going to come in and take it. Or they're going to let them grow something and come steal it all. Or they're going to come tax it to the point that they take that potato and they get 80% of that potato and all you get is 20%. Lack of training children. And how about greed? The wicked is in want. So what happens is a lot of times these sins, even unknown sins, will bring their own discipline. Because if a person has a love of money and they don't know it, and they don't recognize it and identify it, they're never satisfied. And it'll bring its own discipline. It'll bring its own stress level. It'll bring its own problems. Now, chapter 14, we saw in the first seven verses of Proverbs the introduction and the purpose of this compilation of statements. In 1:8 to 9:18, we saw the precepts of wisdom, Proverbs written and directed primarily toward the youth. This outline was in the first part of the study that we did. The third part goes from chapter 10 through chapter 24. And this is called the Proverbs of Solomon. Now, in chapters 10 through 15, we have Proverbs contrasting the godly and the wicked. Look at the way these chapters have been laid out consistently through here. In chapter 10, we kind of had a hodgepodge to the point it was hard to outline. Okay, but then we started getting more structure in 11 and 12 and 13. We get a little structure here. Sometimes the structure is hard to see, but the structure is there. These are the Proverbs, and they're consistently good, bad within the same verse. Good, bad, or bad, good, bad, good. I mean, constantly a contrast that is there. We're going to see more of that through chapter 14 and on into 15. And then from 16 to 22, we're going to see Proverbs that encourage living a godly life. And we've been seeing that already. That's why sometimes people get bored reading the book of Proverbs, but we do know that we learn a lot by repetition. That's how things stick. Now, in the first 11 verses of chapter 14, this is about wise builders. And it's kind of like when we're going down through here, we look for a verse that seems to be just different than the verses that have preceded it. Something that is kind of changed the flow of thought. And from that, we're able to kind of see going from one flow of thought to another flow of thought, and it helps us establish a context, a contextual flow. So in the first 11 verses, the wise woman. How many times have we seen the wise woman in the book of Proverbs? Okay. I haven't, right? So something's different here. Now it jumps in verse 2, starts talking to guys again. Okay, but here what we've seen is the wanton woman, the lips of the adulterer. I mean, we've seen all those things. But when it says, this is a wise woman, builds her house. The word build is bana, B-A-N-A-H, and it is the normal word for building. It was kind of interesting. Adam was manufactured by God, asah, which means to make something out of something. Dust was taken, he put him together, and he squeezed him all together, blew in the breath of lives, and here came Adam. Adam is said to be asad. Eve is said to be banad. She's built from the side of the man. See, so what he did was take a part of that out of Adam, and then he built the woman. So the man is kind of, we're all kind of thrown together, if you will, and she is shaped. Okay, and that's the way God chose to do this. But here is the wise woman, Kakma, Isha, builds Bana, her house, Beit. The Hebrew word for, the second letter of the alphabet, and the Hebrew word for house. The wise woman builds her house. But the foolish, this is the awil word, A-W-I-L, and awil is a word, it's foolish in the sense of irreverent. It's kind of like the word for pride. There are a lot of different words. They translate pride, but they have a slightly different nuance on them. Well, we've seen the word foolish is awil, kasil, two or three other words. This word used 25 times. 23 of the times are in Proverbs. The other two times are in the Psalms. So if you study Hebrew, you learn there's certain terminology they term as poetic vocabulary, because the only place you find it is in Hebrew poetry. You don't find it out in the narrative. And the poetic words try to draw a picture. And this picture, if we tracked all these 25 verses down, would give us a picture of irreverence. So the foolish or the irreverent woman tears it down. And that is the word, I wrote it down wrong in my notes, it's charas, C-H-A-R-A-S. It's not charas. Yep, charas. And we kind of get the word harass out of this. It's kind of where the English comes from. It's only used three times in Proverbs, used 43 times altogether. And this is a word that means to break down by pieces. Now, see, there are words that mean to lay desolate, meaning to bring it low. Walls built high, walls brought low. There are all kinds of words for tear down, destroy, ruin, and do all those. This word has the sense of she's taking it apart a piece at a time. Wise woman builds her house. Okay, the foolish woman, though, has a house and starts pulling it apart. That's what he's saying. With her own hands. Okay, how'd she build it? With her own hands. That's what the wise woman do. What does the foolish woman do? She tears it apart. A piece at a time. Now, irreverence tears down households a piece at a time. That's the main point that's here. I'm trying to summarize these contrasting phrases and put them in kind of a little summary line underneath these verses. Verse 2, he who walks in his uprightness fears the Lord. Okay, uprightness is a word of character, integrity, honor. He who walks is a lifestyle in his uprightness fears the Lord. Now, a person that goes in and tears down the house doesn't seem to really fear the Lord, do they? But he who is crooked in his ways despises him, capital H, despises the Lord. The word crooked is lutz, L-U-T-Z. It's a word for perverse. Means this is a person that likes to spin everything. They say there's a thing called a narcissistic personality disorder. And that is a disorder that one of the identifying qualities of the disorder is a person who's never wrong and it's always your fault. They find a way to take and spin it always, so they never admit to error. They never admit that they made a mistake. They always find a way to spin it and it's your fault. And that, when it is prominent in a person, the sin nature will do that, but when that becomes a lifestyle, they call it a personality disorder. And it says he who is crooked or perverse in his ways despises the Lord. Yahweh despises is the word bazah, b-a-z-a-h, and it means to disrespect. Okay. So fear of the Lord's expressed in behavior. If we really have a fear of the Lord, then there should be some behavior that goes along with it, and it is what? Upright. It is character, as character, moral standards. It is a person that honors other people. I mean, the Bible is loaded with character. What character is, what integrity is, what honor is. Now, in verse 3, it says, in the mouth of a foolish is a rod for his back. And this is part of the stuff that drives me about half crazy. The word they translated back is gah. See if I can get it here. Gah, Ava. I got that wrong. Ava. G-A. I'll just write it down. A-H. It still doesn't. I don't think I got it pointed right. But Ga'ava is a word that does not mean back. I don't know where they got it from. In the mouth of the foolish is a rod for his back. And it's used, the word's used 18 times, 2 times in Proverbs. And it refers to a pride that comes from ornamentation. Now, what does that mean? It means that he looks good. At least in his own mind. It could be through clothing. It could be through stature. It could be through height. It could be through any number of things that he would be prideful about his appearance. But it is a rod for his pride. In other words, in the mouth of the foolish, this is a person who talks to make him look good. That's the best way I can understand it. Somebody that is... when they talk, it's all about them. It's what they've done, what their accomplishments are. And that's foolishness. In the mouth of the foolish is a rod for his pride. In other words, he'll keep talking and whack himself with it. But the lips of the wise will preserve them. Them is the lips. Okay? Person that speaks wise words and doesn't spend all their time trying to convince everybody how great they are. Okay, this is where the spiritual preservation comes in, and that's what the Solomon's trying to get across. People who talk to make themselves look good actually reveal their own shallowness. That's what it's getting at. They're trying to convince everybody they're the smartest or the brightest or the wisest, they're the richest or the whatever they are. They actually reveal how shallow they really are. How about this one? Don't you love this proverb number 4? Where no oxen are, the manger is clean. You know, that's one of those. I always thought we could reconstruct the Bible off camp t-shirts. But I don't think that one's ever been used on a camp t-shirt before. But much increase comes by the strength of the ox. Okay, where might you see a principle like this found in the principle is teaching there's often honorable dirty work. To clean up after the ox in the manger is honorable work, but it's not pleasant. It's dirty work. But it must be done in order to produce good. See, the ox is valuable. The ox makes a mess. You clean up the mess, but you take the mess outside and you use it and put it on the crops or whatever, but it involves another statement of work. And I looked at this. You know, the Lord often asks us to do something that stinks before he blesses us. Now, what would you think that might be? Give me an example of the Lord telling somebody to do something and the response was, but he stinks. Lazarus? Raising a Lazarus from the dead? Roll the stone away. Lord, it's been 3 days. By this time, he stinketh. I love the old English there. He stinketh. And that's the Lord. What did he say? Just roll it away. You know, it's kind of, and he oftentimes asks us to do something that from a human standpoint seems to stink a little bit, but he's got a reward waiting on the other side. Here is this picture about the ox there. If you don't have one, you don't have to go clean it out. You don't have to go in the little barn, in the barn, and take him out of there. There's often some honorable dirty work that's got to be done to produce good that needs to be accomplished. And on the farms, there's a lot of it that goes along. Verse 5, a faithful witness will not lie. Now, Solomon's kind of playing with us here a little bit. Faithful witness will not lie, but a false witness speaks lies. So when one lies, they stop being the word faithful is trustworthy. Emun, E-M-U-N, is a word that's better translated. Faithful's good, trustworthy is okay. I'm not going to split gnats over that. But when one lies, they stop being a trustworthy witness. A faithful witness will not lie. Well, if you lie, you're not a faithful witness. See, that's the counterpart of that. The moment you utter, open your mouth and a lie, you're no longer a faithful witness and you're no longer trustworthy. You become a what? The next thing, a false witness. That's because that's what you're doing, is uttering lies. Verse 6, the scoffer seeks wisdom but finds none. Who are the scoffers but the ones that reject God? Reject His word, reject His plan. The fool says in their heart, there is no God. That's what he says. What does he say? The fool says in his heart, there is no God. But you know, it's amazing how they seek wisdom. You know, the quote I put up Sunday from Carl Sagan, that if the truth will tear it down, it deserves to be torn down. And I thought, of all people to make a statement like that, Carl Sagan, who didn't believe there was a God. He rejected the truth, and he thought the truth was that there was no God. So if you have to tear God down and to get the truth out, then you tear God down. But what happened is he tore himself down. See, he's one of these guys that kept on talking when he should have shut up and started listening. But a scoffer seeks wisdom and finds none. And even somebody who rejects God, where are you going to really get wisdom? The wisdom of the world? What's the world got to offer? Your observation in your limited sphere. Then your perception based on your worldview. And if you put God out of that worldview and only believe what you can see, touch, feel, then guess what? You're never going to find it. A scoffer seeks wisdom, finds none. But knowledge, dot is the stuff, it's just the kind of the gnosis word. It's kind of the input word into the soul. It's easy to the one who has understanding, and that's the word bein, B-I-Y-N, we've seen it many times, discernment. The person that's got discernment, okay, knowledge can get added to that. But if you've got a whole bunch of knowledge, but you don't have wisdom because you're a scoffer, all you're going to have is confusion. You might have a little bit of a part of your world ordered, but it's not going to stay that way. See, you have to start with a big picture, and the big picture is there either is a God or there isn't a God. And can you imagine them? Can you imagine a committee designing the world? Now, think about that. Some people might think, well, there was a whole bunch of gods, and they have always existed. And then they brought it, even in the pantheons of Greek-Roman pantheons, they had a creator God, because they knew creation couldn't be by committee. Okay, they had to have one that did the design, said this is the one we're going with, and laid it out. He says knowledge is easy to the one who has discernment. Those who reject God are not going to find wisdom. They might think they're smart. They might have an IQ that is measured by human standards, but they're really not wise. Verse 7. Leave the presence of a fool. The word leave is a cal imperative of halak. Halak, I think, is in the first vocabulary of a Hebrew student. And I don't know, it was 2,000-3,000 times. Halak means to walk. And it's cool the way the word is used. At times it's used as Noah's Ark walking on the water, which I thought was really cool when I saw using halak. It was walking on the water, and I was going, hey, the Lord walked on the water. You know, there is a connection in the symbolism in that. But you're not going to pick it because it, I think they translated it floated or something like that, and they just missed it. I mean, here is a beautiful picture of the symbolism and the fulfillment and all that. They missed it. Leave, walk away from the presence of a fool. Literally, it says a man of foolishness And he uses the word kesil, K-E-S-I-Y-L, which means silly. Stupid or silly. Okay, so get out of there, or you will not discern words of knowledge. Now, literally it says, or you will not know. And then I have I put in italics, I don't think you have it there, that which comes from the lips. It says literally, or you will not know lips. That's the Hebrew. Of knowledge, i.e. that which comes through the lips in the realm of knowledge. What he's saying is there's nothing to be spiritually gained from association with foolishness. Now, what happens when you find yourself in the presence of somebody that is so silly and so unwise? You might try to educate, you might try to help, offer a word of encouragement. That's what you try to do. But you know what else is also there? A real temptation toward arrogance. And here's this practical knowledge that says when you find yourself encircled by idiots, it's probably a good idea to leave. Okay? You're not going to make any progress. Leave it for somebody else. Doesn't mean you never go back, but what it does mean is you just... I would connect it to redeeming the time, for the days are evil. It's just a massive waste of time. But if you have a chance to input and edify, clarify, take it and do that. But this is kind of what he's saying, you know, you find yourself, you're not making any progress or not going to get any kind of hearing, leave. It's what Jesus told the disciples when they went into the villages. If they don't give you a greeting, welcome into your house, kick the dust off your feet and move to the next village. Okay? Verse 8, the wisdom of the prudent is to understand his way. Prudent is the arum word, A-R-U-M. And arum is a... it's an interesting word, A-R-U-M. A-R-U-M. Arum is used of craftiness. It's used to describe the snake in the garden. And it is a word that can be used of those who are righteous, those who are unrighteous. So it tells us that there is a legitimate craftiness, if you will, a wisdom, a way to figure out how to do things in a righteous way, and how not to violate any of God's standards in doing that. The wisdom of the prudent, you want to be crafty, you want to be cunning, is to understand his, and if you put own way in there, you'll understand the verse. To understand his own way. Okay, we want to take this ability to be crafty. I think we've all got it to some degree. We can figure out a little way. We get crafty when we get 2 or 3 years old and start to walk and talk a little bit. We figure out how to manipulate other people. That's doing it for the wrong reasons. But then you learn how to be kind, you learn how to be gracious, and you don't do it to manipulate them. You just do it because that's the best way to possibly teach them. So it's saying that you're loaded with a practical wisdom. But understand his own way. The person that is really wise in the practical elements of life understands their weaknesses, understands their strengths, is trying to follow the principles of Proverbs, Psalm 119, about learning more about the Word of God and applying it more. He says, but the folly of fools is deceit. So a practical wisdom first understands itself. That's part of what we start. What do we know? What do we not know? We think we know so much. Do not be wise in your own estimation. All your ways acknowledge him. Lean not on your own understanding. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. So we try to look inside and find out what we're lacking and then try to fix it. But a person that just doesn't care, the folly of fools is deceit. They've deceived themselves to begin with. Verse 9, fools mock at sin. And this is the first time we've run into this word. For sin. This word for sin is asham. And you might remember the word kata, translated sin, is used in Leviticus 4 for the sin offerings, the unknown sins. This is the word used in Leviticus 5 for the trespass offerings. These are the known sins. Fools mock at that which is a known sin. It's foolish to laugh at it. It's foolish to encourage it. Fools mock at sin, and they go, well, what is sin? Oh, you call that sin? I don't call that sin. What was that? Well, how about Sodom and Gomorrah? I mean, they just embraced that. And it was a sin. You can't argue that it's not a sin, because God not only put it off limits, it's something that is inherently known in people, that type of activity is wrong. So even the Gentiles who don't have the law knew the law. Romans 2, 14 to 16. What do they know? They've known it in ancient cultures as far back as we can go, that homosexuality, bestiality, all those things were wrong. But fools mock at sin. But among the upright there's goodwill. It's not goodwill. It's ratzon, R-A-T-Z-O-N. And ratzon means acceptable things. We've seen it multiple times before and translated it the same way throughout. Among the upright there is acceptable things. See, known sins is not acceptable. But if you're going to be an honorable person of character, there are some acceptable things. To laugh at known sin is foolishness. Okay? So, verse 10. The heart knows, this is Solomon. I wonder if Solomon knew this is going to be translated into 2,000 other languages whenever he wrote this. Because he put some stuff in here that you have to stop and think, how do we get this into our language? And I know they face the same thing in other languages. How are we going to take this Hebrew and how are we going to get it into another language? He says, the heart knows its not own, but soul's. The heart knows its soul's bitterness. Not its own. Its soul's bitterness. The heart is the center of activity, not the organ that pumps blood. But that center of activity knows the bitterness going on in the soul. Nefesh is a word that looks at the animating principle of life. It is that which gives us life. Animals have it. They have this nefesh, but you hesitate to use that because then people start thinking all dogs go to heaven. I can't answer if they do or not. But you start thinking about things. Well, do dogs have accountability? No accountability and all this because they have a soul. The word soul is a generic word that means that which gives life. Okay? The Lord God breathed into his nostrils the neshama, kayim, which is the breath of lives, and the man, Ha'ish, became a living kaya soul, nefesh. Okay? God gave the animating principle of life into the man, and the man and the woman were different than all the animals. That's the first thing Adam realized. We're different. Now, it says that the heart knows its own bitterness. Bitterness is the word used in Exodus 15:23 of the bad water the Jews ran into. Remember, they had too much water, the Red Sea, not enough water, and they speaking to the rock, or striking the rock, and now they had the bad water at Marah, the waters of Marah. That's the Hebrew word here, M-A-R-A-H, meaning bitter. The heart, the center of activity, what's going on in your life, knows where your soul is bitter, where you're mad at people, where you won't let it go, where there's no forgiveness. And it says, and the stranger does not share its joy. Now that seems like kind of, where do those two sentences get connected? Here's Solomon, first chapter. I'm going to teach you the sayings of a riddle of a wise man, how to figure them out. The word share is arav, A-R-A-B-H. And arav is a word that means to intermingle, to braid, and it has a third masculine singular suffix which connects to the word heart. Because heart is a masculine, the other words there are feminine, so it won't connect back in. A stranger does not share its joy. Joy is the word simcha, which looks at the joy that a person has at a festival. Alright, what is he saying? There's an inner bitterness. When a person has an inner bitterness, it comes through and often overpowers feigned joy. They're at a festival, they're having a good time, and at a big party, and they've got to be happy, and they're putting on this happy face. Okay? And they're acting like everything is really good, but on the inside, where things are really going on in the soul, there's a bitterness. And what he's saying is that the stranger does not share his joy, the stranger's going to see through it. Going to see through the joy that is not really there. They might not be able to identify it. But inner bitterness comes through and often overpowers feigned joy so that others do not want to be around it. A stranger doesn't share its joy. Sometimes people are just they're acting out, and you can just tell there's something deeply wrong. They're not going to talk about it. They're trying to hide it, trying to bury it, trying to do something with it. And he says, people run from it. Verse 11, the house of the wicked will be destroyed. This is a word that means to empty out. We just saw another one destroyed, right? Verse 1, break down into little pieces, and wise woman builds it. Foolish woman tears it down a piece at a time. Here is the house of the wicked, the bait, will be destroyed, which means to empty it out. This houses have stuff in them. Okay, and this is saying that he's going to start moving everything out and then destroy it. That's what this word is indicating. It'll be destroyed, but the tent of the upright. Look at this. This is the house, and it's contrasted to a tent. Now, which one's the most valuable? The house. Okay? In dollar terms, the house is more valuable than the tent. You know, the other day we passed by some neighbors' houses. They had tents out in the front yard. We knew they were teaching their kids how to camp. Okay? Why they had them in the front yard, I don't know. But that's where they had them. I think because the backyard sloped like that. You have to wait for advanced Boy Scout training to sleep on one of those. But the tent, and he uses the word ohel. O-H-E-L. It's not ohel that is there, but it is the Hebrew word ohel. It's hard for Okies to distinguish the difference. But it's a word translated tabernacle. Okay, that's what it's a tent. It's the tent of meetings. The same type of word used there. The tent of the upright will flourish. Flourish is another one of those crazy words, parak, P-A-R-A-C-H. Only used a handful of times. Hifil stem, it means to break forth like a bud. We're in the spring. We see fruit come up. We see flowers come up. And it's so cool to watch the buds. Just the bud appears and then it opens. Okay? This is the contrast that we have in this verse. The house of the wicked is going to be emptied out a piece at a time. Okay? Might not be leveled all at once, but it is something that is going to... It's a promise. See, that's a promise the way he said it. Wickedness will empty out a house, even one built with wisdom. If we look back at verse 1, Okay, the wise woman builds her house. Beit is the word for house. Here it occurs again. See where we've got some connectors on this thought process? Okay. Wickedness will empty out a house, even one that's been built with wisdom. Because when she goes foolish, she goes wicked, and the house gets broken in pieces, one piece at a time. It says, but the tenth of the upright will break forth like a bud. Okay? Second promise. Tents are good places to start growing. They're good to start growing. Okay? And, you know, we can look back, especially some of us older people when we first get married and stuff, and you know, and we haven't got two shekels. Yes. First one is wisdom. You know, you don't have much there, but that's where a house really starts growing. It's not based on the things that we have. It's based on the relationship that we have. And as that relationship develops, then it's not just a house, it's a home. And that's what the wise woman builds her house, Beit, but you could translate it home in there, and we know there's a difference. One's a physical structure, the others are a relational structure. And those two things are vastly, vastly different. And he says, but the tent, you know, you're better off living in a tent, okay? And having this house being flourishing because you're doing what? The tent of the upright, okay? You're walking in the ways of the Lord. What's that? It's a promise. You'll flourish. You'll break forth as a bud. That means you're going to start growing. And the principle, home building is more about the spiritual than the physical. Home building is more about the spiritual than the physical. Now, this is coming from a man that had palaces everywhere. This guy had too many wives to count. I think that was an estimate on the wives and the concubines that he had, rather than being an exact number. Here's a guy named Solomon, and he's trying to get across in these Proverbs that, you know, there's a lot of things a whole lot more important than wealth. And that, you know, the money can't buy me love. I think Solomon first sang that. You know? I think that's what happened, because I think the Song of Solomon was about the one that got away because he messed his life up so bad. That's what I think it was about. Anyway, that's for another class. That was a drive-by, so I'll have to leave it at the drive-by and we'll go from there. But anyway, Solomon, interesting guy, isn't he? You know, we get to sit down and eat with him. We get to sit down and eat with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. We're told that, but that's when the Old Testament saints come out of the ground, get their bodies. That's cool. We get to eat dinner with them. I think we'll get to sit down and, Solomon, what got into your head to have all those wives? What? Anyway, it'll be fun. We'll all laugh and have some good food and a good time. Let's pray. Thank you, Father, for this day. It is good. It's the one you have made. You've let us rejoice by opening up your word once again and feeding upon it and letting us see the really important things in this life. I pray we'll not forget them, but I pray that we'll be able to use them wisely to your glory. It's in Jesus' name we ask it. Amen.